Hello, I'm Ed Schnitzer of Wobble Bond Dickinson, U.S. LLP.
Hi, I'm Connor Bifferato of the Bifferato Firm, and we're the co-chairs of ABI's Mediation Committee.
We'd like to welcome you to the committee's podcast called Reframing Mediation. On this and future episodes, we'll be tackling bankruptcy mediation decisions or trends that we found interesting or that you should be aware of in your practice. So what's our plan for today's podcast? We decided that the listeners have probably heard enough of Connor and my voice. We've invited two guests to join us. Connor, would you like to introduce our two guests?
It would be my pleasure. Our first guest is Kara Castile. Kara is the head of ASK's bankruptcy litigation practice and represents trustees, committees, and debtors in possession in preference analysis and the litigation of avoidance actions. Kara has successfully litigated preference and fraudulent transfer matters in multiple jurisdictions, including the United States Bankruptcy Court for the District of Delaware, Southern District of New York, Southern District of Texas, and the Southern District of Indiana. We are also fortunate to have with us today Luke Murley. Luke is a partner at Saul Ewing in their Wilmington, Delaware office. Luke has substantial experience representing debtors, committees, acquirers, fiduciaries, and other significant parties in interest in complex reorganizations and financially distressed situations, both in and out of court. Luke has extensive experience litigating matters in bankruptcy courts throughout the country. He has defended firm clients in over 130 avoidance actions, an aggregate total of over $280 million in alleged transfers. Both Kara and Luke have substantial mediation experience, and that is why we have invited both of them to join us on today's podcast.
Thanks, Connor, and thank you to Kara and Luke for joining us today. Let's get to what our listeners want, information from Kara and Luke. Our first question will be to Kara. Kara, you've handled the prosecution of numerous preferences. Tell us generally, what do you do to prepare a written mediation statement when you're representing a plaintiff in a preference matter?
Thanks, and thanks both of you for having me on this afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity. My number one goal when I'm preparing for mediation and doing a statement is, how can I get rid of any factual disputes so that we don't waste anyone's time and we can get straight to the law? Generally, the parties might not really highlight that their histories don't line up in the preference in the historical period. They might not have provided evidence of new value, and they're asserting it. They might have hinted at financial hardship, but never actually provided any evidence. So in the week prior to a scheduled mediation, and depending on the size of the case, that might start a week or two prior to that, but definitely within the week, I'm looking on the claims docket to see if I can find any information about their claims that maybe they originally filed and they didn't bother to, tell their counsel. I'm looking to see what history they maybe sent 6 months to a year ago that the parties put aside and really didn't look at that is kind of part of the dispute that they didn't realize. I might be Googling them to see if they have financial problems or if they're a huge company so that if they make a financial, a claim, I can say, well, that's interesting based on the news. When I get to mediation, I want it to just be, here's my legal argument. Here's their legal argument. Let's have the mediator talk to us and tell us if we are really out of line or don't really know the weaknesses of our case. If I have to spend the first hour mediating, arguing why our new value is right and the opponent's new value is wrong, in my opinion, that's an hour wasted of good mediation. So to me, the best way for me to prepare is getting my facts in a row so that all that is left in the mediation statement is for me to argue the law.
Thanks, Kara. As there are two sides, of course, in every mediation at least, let's turn to Luke. Luke, if you're defending in a preference action that has been sent to mediation, what do you do in preparing a mediation statement?
I do almost no preparation specifically in a mediation statement because I think if I haven't if I'm maxed up, if I'm matched up against Kara and Kara sees something in my mediation statement for the first time, that's on me, right? I should have already communicated everything to her, all my best positions, all information that she needs ahead of time. And so really my mediation statement is really for the benefit of the mediator who hasn't seen all that, probably, and to have that in a one place, but it's really just gathering things that I better have told Kara in the long before this, because, you know, my view is that if your opponent is knows what they're doing and is rational and is just thinking of the bottom line and trying to get through this, if we're going ahead with mediation, that means something's broken down somewhere, probably. And it could be on our client end. It could be on the other side. You know, it could be a combination of things. It could be people are busy and somebody was sick or something. But if your opponent is sophisticated and knows what they're doing and has done this before, and you guys can't settle it between the two of you, you need the mediator's help, that probably means something's broken down. So the answer to the question, what do I have in the mediation statement? Really just gathering and putting together things that I've already told Kara most of the time.
Interesting hearing from both of you is the theme I heard is you don't really want anything in mediation to be new. If you both done your job, which of course you have, but if your adversary has as well, you're both talking about mediation. Basically, no surprises, nothing new, just a legal discussion where you, I guess at that point you want help from the mediator because it hasn't happened on your own for some reason.
See, this is why I like having Luke as opposing counsel is we don't have to go to mediation that often. I agree that generally there's some breakdown somewhere other than a strict pure legal issue, which is nice to have, you know, a mediator weigh in on. But if I'm dealing with Luke, then generally we have discussed everything ahead of time. And a lot of times as mediation is coming up, then the parties say, you know, I think we can do this ourselves. So I'm sorry I don't see you more, Luke.
Yeah. Oh, I was thinking, I haven't seen that. I can't remember the last time. But I, you know, even if you can't narrow down everything, at least what you're giving your mediator is here's a limited number of things that we can't come to head on. And that could be whatever, some legal issue about, you know, inside baseball, whether we get substitute new value credit for 503B9 in this jurisdiction. You know, that's what we can't do. Or what kind of range we get in the ordinary course. So you're not just dumping it on the mediator saying, all right, figure all this out for us. You're giving them, here's what we figured out among the two of us before coming to mediation. And here are the two or three things that we'd like you to help us with.
As you both pointed out, it really experienced litigators very rarely need to go to mediation because there's not too many surprises that you're hitting each other with. It's been my experience, and Ed, I'm interested in your opinion, and Luke and Kara as well. 99% of the time where you got really good litigators on both sides of the case, the reason a matter goes to mediation is because you need help with a party understanding, you know, what the weaknesses or strengths may be and why there's a benefit to resolving the matter before going to trial. Does that sound right?
Yeah, no, I certainly agree. That's something extra that a you or me or, you know, another mediator could add to it that parties, weren't able to do. And I mean, and I also know from my own experience, sometimes I have a client that's not as easy as I would like them to be. And while I think they should settle, and if I'm defending, I think I personally find defending harder because you're paying someone money as opposed to, you know, taking money. But sometimes it's hard to convince a client to settle, particularly on a preference when outside of bankruptcy, it doesn't make sense. It's not like a fraudulent transfer where you weren't entitled to the money, a preference, you actually were entitled to the money, but that's the problem. So there are sometimes a client needs to hear A, from the other side directly so that it's not coming through me, or B, needs to hear from a mediator like Connor telling them, look, you may be right, but this is how much it's gonna cost you and this is what's gonna happen. And you know, it might make sense to settle now rather than spend more later.
And clients never like to hear their own lawyers telling them to settle for some reason. They want their own lawyers to say fight, fight, fight all the time. So that can be a difficult ask as well.
And Connor, the other thing I noticed from what was discussed and kind of what you said about a litigator, and I'm blanking on the name of a decision, but I remember a decision out of Texas from in the recent, you know, last 5 years where the judge was upset that the parties were going to mediation because felt like the parties didn't necessarily give it a chance first themselves. And I recall this judge being not a fan of mediation and basically said, I don't understand why two professionals can't resolve this themselves. And I guess I liked what I heard here. If I was that judge, as a mediator, perhaps I don't like it because it means I'm not going to be employed if Kara and Luke are adversaries. But from the perspective of this Texas judge, I liked what I heard here. Because if you two are in mediation, it's not because you didn't try and just said, oh, let's just go to mediation. You know, we're not even going to try first or so. You tried and you tried a bunch and you exchanged all sorts of information. And for whatever reason, it wasn't happening. So mediation wasn't your first choice, probably wasn't even your second, third, or fourth choice. It was you've tried all sorts of things. And now this is another thing to try because it's still better for the most part than actually going to the, you know, end of a trial hearing, you know, motion practice, whatever it may be.
Yeah. And I think what everybody's saying, and that this is my experience too, is that the real reason you're going to mediation is not because of some exotic factual issue or legal issue. It's some personality and some combination, right? And it could be any number of things. It could be the small business has got hit by a preference and wants to fight, says he wants to fight on principle. Like there's that version.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's the version of, you know, me being the bankruptcy person bringing along a client, and it's a relationship of one of my transactional partners. And I, you know, that transactional partner is not familiar and is in the relationship. So it, you know, maybe sometimes I wouldn't be as more blunt as if I was doing a mediation for someone where I've led them through four or five, because they begin to hit a lot of those. It's all permutations and combinations therein about what could be the disconnect. And very rarely is it about a legal issue or a factual issue. I think it's more about a human issue.
Yeah. And to be kind to defendants, because I actually have defended a few cases, believe it or not, which was great because it gave me appreciation for competent opposing counsel and the issues they face dealing with preference defendants. But, you know, on the other side, some trustees are very, very busy. They're very numbers oriented and they have a contingency fee. So they are not personally invested in all the costs. And it might be easy prior to a mediation to say, OK, well, get more, or, you know, this is not going to settle for that. But when they actually have to show up and take time out of their busy day to hear from a mediator that it's not as simple as numbers, that's not how this works, it can be on that side, too. None of my clients, of course, they're all wonderful and very personally invested and responsive in each and every one. But it can be on both sides, too. So I don't want to just poke fun of defendants who it's very real to a lot of them.
But very helpful. And Connor, just one last thing before we switch to the next topic. I thought it might be helpful. You know, Kara, you mentioned how sometimes, you know, defendants bring up financial distress, or sometimes they don't, but you try to look into it in advance. I think it might be helpful to have both of you speak about that a little bit. And again, I'll go to Kara first. Kara, if you're representing a plaintiff, what would you want or expect from a defendant in a mediation statement if they're going to raise financial distress? What do you want to see so that you feel like you can, you know, you and your client can take that into consideration, you know, at mediation?
Well, to echo Luke, if the mediation statement is the first time I'm hearing of it, something has gone terribly wrong. A mediation where the mediator is dealing with financial hardship is a waste of time to everyone, in my opinion. I want audited financial statements. I want tax returns. I want, if they don't have audited, unaudited statements, bank statements, anything they can show that shows they don't have the ability to pay at all, or they don't have the ability to pay immediately, they need to pay over time. I mean, the vast, if not all of my clients are very reasonable professionals, whether that's trustees or people in charge of a debtor in possession. They're not looking to put another entity into bankruptcy. They're looking to try to treat people fairly. And if a defendant truly doesn't have the ability to pay, then let's, you know, then it's pointless to try to get money from them or put them into bankruptcy. And so, you know, I get the documents, we take a review. If it justifies a departure from the net preference, then we'll say so. And if it doesn't, we'll say why it doesn't. And then in our mediation statement, we'll say they have claimed hardship. This is why we don't think that's an issue in this case. If I'm reading about it in the mediation statement or I'm hearing about it in mediation, that is just sideways. I cannot tell you how frustrating it is when someone pounds the table with legal defenses and I have prepared in good faith to address those legal defenses, and I learn at the doorstep it's financial hardship. That does no one a service. So that's frustrating.
I hear you and have felt the same. So certainly, you know, don't disagree with you there. Luke, on the defense side, hopefully you haven't had a client with a financial inability to pay, at least inability to pay legal fees, but assuming they have some sort of financial issues, what have you offered, or what would you recommend be offered to a plaintiff that you'd be comfortable sharing?
I think the way, I'll give you the speech that I give whenever that subject comes up. We talk about, well, okay, so say we're on the hook for this $1 million preference. It's good luck trying to collect, right? And why don't we tell that to the plaintiff? What my standard speech at that point is, yes, this plaintiff is a rational maximizer, right? They are dispassionate, and they do not want to get a judgment just for having a judgment. They want money. And if their judgment against you is not worth anything, they want to know that, and they'll probably give you a settlement discount. In order to get that settlement discount, you're going to have to do much more than tell me to put it in the mediation statement. You're going to have to give some backup information. And if you're talking about an entity that, especially a small one, that's in financial distress, you know, they may not have the most perfect financial records or audited financial statements, but you can probably find something. And so it's more than just your word. In the end of that speech is that unless you're willing to give that stuff, in my experience, you're not going to get any settlement discount. Because you're not giving them that rational maximizer a basis to justify to presumably someone they've got to justify internally why they're giving you a settlement discount, notwithstanding the actual exposure.
Thank you. I think very, very useful and very sound advice. Since I interrupted a bunch, Connor, now why don't we go on to a second topic?
So yeah, that brings us to the mediation conference itself. And before you arrive at the door, there's hopefully a lot of work to be done. So let's talk about, Luke, you've got a mediation scheduled for, let's say, a couple of weeks, and it's a matter that you're representing a party. It's a significant claim. Can you tell us what you do to prepare for that mediation?
If I don't know the parties involved, then I'd see what I can to know that. If I don't know plaintiff's counsel, if I don't know who is on the, if there's a trust, who's on the oversight board, like it's much easier to get something done when you know the other person. If you don't, I'm not going to be able to know that person, quote unquote, before the mediation, but I'll try to get there. And then, in addition to the mediation statement, I want to be prepared for what plaintiff throws at me. And that could be, mean the following, like maybe Kara and I are talking in selling a preference, and we're mixing and matching the subsequent new value defense and the ordinary course of business defense. And we have a position that says our exposure is X if we give this credit for the ordinary course of business. And I have an analysis. But surprise, surprise, Kara says my range of ordinary course of business is too wide and I should make that narrow. I think it's really effective to have all that printed out on big paper that everyone can see rather than, some 8.5 by 11 that you've emailed, and say, okay, so this is the range that if plaintiff's right on our ordinary course, and this is our exposure, and to have that ready, because I think when you're a defendant and you're looking to get out of something for as little as possible, your options to keep the conversation going, to keep movement going, is to throw up some more money. That's one option. The other option is to throw out, more constructs or more ideas, legal theories, and that can also keep things going. So I definitely need to do that. The other things I want to do before I show up at a mediation is to understand, number one, what the client's claims are, meaning unsecured claims and what they're potentially worth, any 503B9, any post-petition administrative claim, because those could be used as currency for settlement. But then the second also relevant question, if I can, I'm going to figure out how opposing counsel is compensated. Because if opposing counsel is discompensated about the size of the check that they get from us and not a waiver of claims, then it has no real value and I should hold on to those. You can't always figure that out. Sometimes it'll be post-confirmation estate. We're not privy to how people are compensated. But other times you can do that homework and it'll give you a little insight. And also when the plaintiff and the mediator aren't there. It'll make you look like you're a smart counsel that's thought everything to your client. They'll hire again for the next one.
Important consideration for any preparation, mediation included. So let me ask just briefly on that follow-up, Luke. Is there any different approach that you take if you're representing the estate in an adversary proceeding?
I've never done a mediation on the plaintiff side. I've done a little bit of it, and we just settled before. But what I would imagine you'd want to do is do sort of the mirror image of what I'm doing on the defense side, getting to know the parties, figuring out what are the different models, and being, you know, being ready to sort of head off any kind of what I would normally do on the defense side is, here's a different model. Even if I'm wrong in the construct that I have in the mediation statement, my exposure is still low under this alternative model. To be ready for those, be ready for that that joust at the mediation.
Sure, you want to. And a few days before mediation, it's always useful to say, "Well, I think this might be a conduit." I'm kidding, of course, but Kara. And that's something you hear a lot, and it, not from Luke, of course. I'm joking about
of
that.
Of course not.
What do you do, representing a lot of estates and a lot of trusts? What do you do for preparing for mediation, both you and your client?
So I have to go to something Luke said, which I thought was brilliant, looking up whether or not their contingency fee. And I know post-confirmation that's not publicly available. And we don't do all contingency. The vast majority is contingency just based on the nature. I think that's extremely helpful for getting things done, because I've run into people who don't do preferences all the time, and they're just like, why are you pursuing this case? This is not financially worth it to the trust. You are just going to run into the ground with legal fees. And I'm like, well, my client isn't, but your client might. And if you go into that blind and you have no idea, I think that really does do a disservice to your client, because the math is just different. Especially when you're dealing with a trustee who has economy of scale and is doing 50 of these and might have 3 mediations in one day, and it's not there. So I think that's brilliant. And I think if people aren't looking for that, or, you know, generally find out if that's how the arrangement is with a firm and their clients, that's powerful information to give your client. But as far as how I prepare, I do the same thing that Luke does, which is that I don't want to sell my client the best case scenario without telling them the pitfalls. And I generally say, here's what I'm asserting in our case. Here, this is our best case scenario. And I'm selling it the best I can, but here's what they're arguing. Here's the risks. I might even put a grid, like, here's our OCB range. Here's their OCB range. Here's it with 503b9 new value. Here's without 503b9 value. So here's the matrix of recovery we're realistically looking at. So, you know, while I'm going for this, somewhere in between is probably where we want to land today to assess the legal risk. So client prep, especially, you know, if it's a trustee, they're not going to have day-to-day knowledge of each and every case. So making sure they pay attention to this case and understand its details is really important, so that they don't have a false idea of the risks of the case. So client education.
Yeah, that's a client education. I should have mentioned that too. You might be surprised that even on like sophisticated in-house counsel, when they go to the mediation, sometimes people are bad at playing poker, right? And I will prepare them for the. All right, so this is really recorded. All right, so I'm going to deny this if anyone uses this. But like, part of what we do at a mediation is to play a certain role. And it could be to play the role of someone that is in love with their case and has no trouble filing a summary judgment if we don't settle. And to play that role for all it's worth, and to be convincing of it. And, you know, sometimes we really mean to. But just to do some client education, to talk about the things that are going to come out of my mouth here are different than the things that might come out of my mouth when the door's closed, to prepare them for that. I think that's important. And as Takara said, just the plain old client education, so that if they hear something, they hear about a risk, it's not the first time they've heard it, if they hear it in the joint session with everyone in the room.
to give Luke some defense, we perhaps could have said what Connor and I said on our last podcast. We started our intro with something like, anything we state here is just for purposes of this podcast. It may not be used against us. So the same holds for Kara and Luke. And as to what Luke says, I will add, I've definitely had prep sessions before with a client where we discussed whether the client representative, it would be helpful if the client representative expressed anger, particularly to the mediator, at having to be there and how this was, you know, ridiculous, and, you know, a few other choice words. And I certainly said if that is how they feel and they could express it in a louder manner, that would certainly be fine. I was not going to do that because lawyers supposed to perhaps not do that, but it's great to sometimes have a client there, you know, be a little hysterical. Sometimes hysterics are good.
I'm interested in all of your opinions on this, and it's been my experience recently. I've had the opportunity to do a couple of fairly complex personal injury mediations, and they involve significant dollar amounts, unusual circumstances. You know, one was a building burning down, but I have been amazed, and it could be the lawyers, and maybe it's PI lawyers and PI defense lawyers preparing their clients. I have found, long time ago and now, commercial litigants, lawyer in-house people who should be either lawyers or representatives who should be used to the business judgment idea and concept, tend to be far more emotionally attached to their position than people who are dealing with, you know, real personal loss that affects them individually. Have you all had that experience?
Yeah, I there have been times where I've been surprised about sort of the emotional stakes that people have that doesn't, you know, I understand if it's your business, it's your family business, that's it.
Sure.
For this preference, you know, where you're a publicly traded company and this doesn't, you're not going to move the needle, you know, even in the worst case. But like, I think it comes down to sort of my view about why things settle, why they don't settle. It comes down to sort of weird human issues, and it may not have anything to do with 547 of the bankruptcy code or the rules of evidence. It might be, you know, that person is going through something personally.
Yeah. I agree. Sorry, Ed.
No, nothing to add. I wasn't sure, Kara, any thoughts on that?
Oh, no, I was just thinking sometimes that part of the emotions, I think, and this is a whole different topic, but when you think you have someone with settlement authority and it turns out that they're not the person with settlement authority and the person with settlement authority has told them they can't get, it's X, Y, or Z, or we're done. And I think some of that pressure comes out when, you know, they are stressed thinking they have to get it done under those orders. And you know, they are there in person and they see it's different in person, which is the point of having a person with settlement authority to be at the mediation. So that adds a whole other emotional element to these.
A lot of different factors that create pressure that aren't always apparent.
Well, great. I mean, I think we've covered what we thought would be of interest to the listeners. Connor, anything else you think we should add before thanking Luke and Kara for their time?
I'd love to talk to them about every aspect of the mediation conference itself, and maybe we should invite them back to do that over time. But I know our time is short, and we've been really fortunate, and I know, Ed, I speak for you, we're extremely grateful to have had such experienced litigators and friends here today.
Well, thank you, Luke and Kara. We do appreciate it. To our listeners, we look forward to recording our next Reframing Mediation podcast, and we thank you for listening. This podcast series and an archive of nearly 300 other ABI podcasts can be found in the newsroom at abi.org and also on your regular podcast mobile app. Until next time, have a great day.